It's the Mike Tech Show, show number 456. This show is a proud member of the Tech Podcast Network. If it's tech, it's here. Please visit techpodcast.com. Welcome to the podcast. I'm your host, Mike Smith. Thank you very much for downloading and subscribing to the show. Please visit the main website at miketechshow.com. You can email me suggestions for future show topics or any question. My email address is miketechshow@gmail.com. You can leave me a voicemail message, and we have one voicemail for tonight. The phone number is 240-949-2450, and that's Mike Tech Show, all one word, on Skype. You can follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/MikeTechShow, and send me a friend request on Facebook, facebook.com/MikeTechShow, and don't forget the wiki, which is mtswiki.com. There you'll find links to all of the past shows, the audio content, the show notes. Great resource, and that's maintained by Citizen X from the chat, and it's hosted by Winston Wolf. And last week, the wiki was under a major attack from Chinese and Russian bots that were attacking MediaWiki, which is what the wiki's based on. And it was, and he was having some major errors and problems with the database. The hosting company used to be 1&1, and Winston used to talk so highly about them. Well, he ran into some significant problems with 1&1, and he had to transfer the website to a different hosting company. And as soon as he transferred it, it was immediately... And those bots and those attacks from Russia and China, they were able to be blocked. And that hosting company is Bluehost. So a big thumbs up to Bluehost and a big negative to 1&1, who basically told Winston that, guess what? You're out of luck. You're on your own for the problems that was happening, and they couldn't block anything. You want to keep that in mind when you're evaluating websites. And you know what? I've asked Winston to put together a detail diving into that for us, and I can come back and give you a lot more technical details on the specifics of that attack and how it's been thwarted now by Bluehost. Big thank you for Winston for going through all that and hosting the Mike Tech Show wiki. Jam-packed show. Stack of email that I'm going to get to. I have the one voicemail message, but there are a few things I want to talk about. One, a client of mine innocently received a fax, and he gets this fax saying that he's got to renew his domain. They wanted a credit card and $650 for 10 years of the domain. And he thought this was legitimate. And one of the things that you got to be careful, he was able to get the charge removed, and the company took care of it. I look at this as a scam, even though it's a legitimate company selling domains. They were selling him the .us for the domain. So let's say he was abc.com. They sent him a fax saying all the verbiage about abc.com, and then in the fine print, you're buying abc.us for the next 10 years. He was able to reverse all this, and everything was fine, but to me, that's a scam, even though by the letter of the law, it's not a scam, but it's something you need to be aware of. Something else I'm seeing, two home clients this week emailed me saying they received a call from someone identifying them as a Microsoft tech and that they had many errors. My clients knew to say no thanks and hung up. That's another scam where what they'll do is they'll work you to get remote access to your machine, have you go in and maybe go to PayPal and make a payment or give them your credit card. And again, that's a scam that you want to make sure that Microsoft will never call you. No one will call you and say you got errors on your system and it's got to be taken care of. So my clients luckily are trained with that. My client that I performed the new server build two weeks ago, he needed his email. One of the things when we rebuilt the system, we had a discussion on email and he said, they rarely use it, so don't even worry about the old Exchange email. They can just live going forward. So I did not do an Exchange recovery. So now he needs the email. And luckily, there was an OST file on his desktop. The first link for tonight is the utility. And I go to these guys a lot. It's SysTools. And I've used it to recover the Outlook Express database corruption. Well, SysTools OST recovery worked beautifully. We were able to buy that for $99 and you get two computers to use it for. And we converted his 2 gig OST file to a beautiful PST that he was able to read everything. That utility is great. Now, I first downloaded the Exchange recovery, the demo mode, and tested it against the unmounted EDB database files, and it could read it. But the price of that utility is $299. So it was basically the same mail. Since everything was cached in the OST file, it was cheaper to recover his email just by spending the $99 as opposed to the bigger utility for the $299. The point is, you can recover mail from an unmounted EDB database. And I was able to do it testing. It's just that you can't write to the PST unless you buy it. But I was able to see the emails right from an unmounted information store. And that is incredible. This website, this SysTools recovery, they are my go-to website for utilities for doing these kind of recoveries and repairs for email. But they're not free, but they're solid and they work. So that's why I highly recommend them. I have a question to my Mac experts out there that are listening to the show. I have a client that is getting the gray screen of death. Yes, for those of you that did not know that we're familiar with the blue screen of death in the Windows world, well, Mac users get a gray screen of death. And I have been researching this, and I can't find a common solution to this problem. When they boot up, it's not every time. It's only occasional, and only when they reboot because maybe there was an upgrade or a system update, and they get, it's just all gray screen and some odd colors. The hard drive's fine. The permission's fine. I haven't checked the memory, but I know the hard drive is, there's no issues. And if they try to reboot a couple times, it'll eventually take and it'll boot up. The question is, what's wrong? And I put this out to, I gotta wait to hear back. I have one real good Mac expert that I know, and I'm waiting for some feedback. But in the meantime, if you can come up with some ideas on what I can look at and how to possibly remedy this permanently, so this way they don't get that occasional gray screen of death, I would really appreciate it. Here's the voicemail question for tonight.
Hey, Mike, how you going? This is Richard Claypool, and I have a stupid question for you, but the ones that you never asked are the ones that you never find out an answer to. And I've done research on this, but I've gotten conflicting results. I was always under the impression that if you, let's say, had a 2 gigahertz dual-core processor, right, that each core was running at 1 gigahertz, so you look at the total. But I've heard that, no, that's not true, that each core is actually running at 2 gigahertz. And I looked it up in different places, and I've read different things on the subject. So could you please clarify this once and for all? I respect your opinion, and that's why I figured I'd ask. Okay, as I said, sorry for this stupid question. I do know a lot about computers, but this one, I'm not sure about. So, all right, thank you so much, man. Love the show.
Thanks, Richard. I appreciate the voicemail. I don't have the technical explanation, but I know this, and I actually confirmed this. I asked Carrie this the other night. The megahertz is per core. That I know, and I believe it was someone from Intel that I remember reading something. So if you have a quad-core 3 gigahertz system, each core is 3 gigahertz. You don't split it up amongst the cores. So it is for each individual core. Let's catch up on email here. And this was sent to me by Jason a few weeks ago. And the subject is calendar sync. Mike, why not do something that everyone can be on board with and just use the Gmail calendar? I have 2 kids, and keeping up with them and my wife and where my wife wants me to be, we both have Gmail accounts and just share a calendar that we made and called family. You can create as many calendars as you want. So I have all the doctor appointments, family dinners, and whoever, and pretty much anything else that's going on with the family on there. Gmail calendar is easy to use and cross-platform with any device. On the other side, my company uses Gmail apps for business, and all our techs put the service calls on their calendars, and we all share calendars so we can see where everybody is at any given time. Also, my main in-shop tech is able to schedule our other tech service calls when customers call in and want to set up a service call. So all he has to do is just add it to the appropriate person's calendar, and we are scheduled. We usually put items such as address, phone numbers, and notes about the job or what the tech may need to bring with them in the description of the calendar appointment. Being an Android hardcore fan and Google Apps for Business and personal Gmail user, I am in pretty deep with Google. So I may be a little biased, but it is simple, easy to use, and free. Hope this helps. Great suggestion. And everybody in my house is a Gmail user. This is in response to trying to get all of the family events coordinated. And that's where Mike recommended Cozy. I like it, and I'm trying to get everybody on that, and it's just hard getting everybody on board. This is great, Jason. Thank you. This is from John. Hosted Exchange thoughts and ideas. Hi, Mike. I love your podcast as well as Tech Bets. They are my 2 favorite tech podcasts, and I listen to each one you put out there. Thanks for sharing your knowledge and experience in the IT industry. I've learned a lot from you on your show and from you and Carrie on Tech Vets. I do a little work on the side and have an infrequent client who has an SBS 2003 server that's hosting Exchange. He has about 10 users and mailboxes. A few months ago, he signed up for Hosted Exchange but hasn't gotten it set up yet, so he's wasting money each and every month that goes by. He's asked if I'd be interested in setting this up for him, and I told him I would. I have never done it before. Moving an on-site Exchange setup to Hosted Exchange, and was just wondering what pointers and tips you might be able to share with me and the rest of your podcast listeners. Google is my friend as well, so I'm going to start looking there for some generic information until I have more details from the client. At this time, I have no information from him concerning who's hosting the DNS. Oh, that's huge. What the login is to gain access to that information, whether that login has full access to change things, such as the MX record, what company he's using for the hosted exchange service, etc. I'm hoping that the company he's using has some decent documentation on how to make the switch. But since you never know what you'll get, I wanted to run this by you. I can't do anything for the client for a couple of weeks, so he's quite busy with work until then anyway. So I have some time to gather some information in order to come up with an initial game plan. Any thoughts and ideas you might have would be appreciated. Thanks for the help and on all the good work. John, first thing, you need to know how to change the MX records for him. So where is his DNS hosted? So go to whois.sc, see who the registrar is for where the domain is registered. Once you do that, get his login information, go in there, and see if that is the records. Right now, you can also go to MX Toolbox and see what the MX records are and who's hosting those MX records. Once you get a handle on that and you know you can access and make the change, obviously you're not going to make it, but you're going to get everything ready so when that day comes, you're going to have control. You must have that. Next, take a look at the Exchange Server admin. Make sure you have admin access to the SBS 2003 server. Go in and run a report. How big is everybody's email? It's very easy to run a report where you can actually export it to a text file, a comma delimited file, or a CSV file that you could just bring up in Excel, and it will list everybody and how much mail, you know, you're dealing with. If everybody is under 2 gigs, you can use a utility called EXMerge. You're going to have to do for this conversion is put a stake in the ground and say, this is the moment where all new mail will go to the new exchange server. You have to create all of the new accounts on the new exchange hosted site, and you got to change the MX records. You have this all scheduled and planned, and I like doing something like this on a Friday evening. Now that you've changed the records, you send a test message to one of the accounts and you make sure you're getting mail. Once you've done that, you've now stopped mail from coming into the existing exchange server. You go and you can run the EXMerge utility against the information store, and it will export all of the user's mail into individual PSTs. Now you have all of their email in a PST. Does the exchange hosted service provide a way for you to upload them and then marry those PSTs to the hosted email? SureWeb has that capability. Now that you got all of their email, you now need to go to their Outlook clients and make sure you know where their PSTs are. And now create new profiles going to the new hosted exchange service. Now you can import the PST that you did from the server. Or if there's a way for the server, the new server hosted company to be able to import it, follow their instructions. You absolutely want to check to see if there's documentation. I am available for help in this scenario, and you can email me, mike@mhsconsulting.net, and I can help you. I have migrated several clients to exchange hosted services. So I have been through this. I know the pain and the ins and outs, and I can kind of work around any issue that's thrown at us. So if you need some consulting help, I am available. But I've basically laid out the structure for you to be successful with this. Next email from Steve. I'm a computer tech too, among other things, and I've been trying to research this problem for a while and still can't figure it out. By the way, your podcasts are wonderful. I have Windows 7 installed on an SSD. I also installed Windows 8 onto another mechanical drive. So both OSs show up in my Windows boot menu, and both OSs work as expected. Here's the problem. I want to dump my Windows 8 and probably install it onto my SSD. When I simply unplug the Windows 8 mechanical drive, Windows 7 won't boot and tells me that there's no boot device. I've tried going into my BIOS and setting the boot drive to my SSD, deleting the Windows 8 entry from the boot tab of msconfig system configuration, using a BCD edit app to delete the boot entry, booting into safe mode with command prompt and using BCD edit to delete the entry. None of these fixes seem to work, and all of my fixes either don't show the Win8 entry or they prevent my computer from booting to Windows 7. I'm out of fixes. Can you help? Here's what I suggested. You must edit the bootini file on the SSD and tell it to have the right partition number and make sure it's pointing to the right drive number and the right partition of the drive to boot Windows 7. Anytime I've even had servers that we've done recoveries on, or anytime where there are different drives involved, you've just changed that drive scenario to where it's not drive 1 or drive 0. You know, you've just changed the drive number by removing a drive, so therefore the bootini is going to point to the wrong drive. I really believe the answer is editing in the bootini and telling it where the OS is, and that's going to work. Steve wrote back that he's going to try it, but I haven't heard whether that was successful or not. And remember, the bootini is protected. So you have to unprotect the file, edit it, and then protect it again. Jorge, hi, Mike. I have a customer that needs to have their company email to be HIPAA compliant. How do I know if a service provider is providing HIPAA compliance email? Great question. They must provide what they call a SAS 70 document saying that they are compliant with whatever compliance is, whether it's Sarbanes-Oxley or FINRA. You need to contact their, I guess, pre-sale support and say, hey, I need to know, show me a document that states that you are HIPAA compliant. And if they are not, you cannot use them. So you now need a service that is HIPAA compliant. You're going to need services like SMARSH, S-M-A-R-S-H. There are services out there that provide the alphabet soup of compliance. Great question. And you got to query them. And if you can't find it on their website or they won't provide it, then you assume they are not compliant and you move on. This is from Michael, administrative privileges. What's your opinion on letting users have local administrative privileges in a domain? I only give local administrative privileges if someone really demands it. I advise them that having administrative privileges increases the risk of a virus infecting the system. Otherwise, I leave them as a limited user and install software that they request. That's fine. Now, I like your policy, and that's how I like it. I don't like everybody being an administrator, but you use the word domain. Now, I would let someone be a local administrator to their computer. Never, ever, ever will I allow a user to be a domain administrator. They will never have administrative privileges on the domain unless they are the owner of the company or the owner of the company has specifically delegated that person to be allowed to have those privileges. I am the only one that will have domain admin privileges, and I will give that password to the owner or CEO or president of the company. If they demand domain admin privileges, I'll give it to them, but I also give them the caveat, hey, if you, you know, accidentally do something, you could screw everything up. That usually works when I'm dealing with the owner of the organization, and we never, ever allow anyone to have domain admin privileges. This is from Karen. QuickBooks, resources, and a question on Hyper-V and virtual machines. Hi, Mike. Sorry, just getting caught up on some older episodes, particularly the one where you were looking for good resources for QuickBooks. We have a company that provides import utilities to QuickBooks called Transaction Pro Importer, so we deal with all sorts of questions every day. This is what I would suggest. Radio Free QuickBooks at radiofreeqb.com. They have a lot of great videos and other resources online, plus they have a very entertaining radio show on Blog Talk Radio. This week, they talked about Bitcoins. The QuickBooks and Beyond blog at Sleeter, Sleeter.com/blog. They have both informative and also some very technical issues regarding QuickBooks. For instance, they recently had an article on how PDFs are integrated with QuickBooks. NerdEnterprises.com. Seth David is a QuickBooks expert, and he has a lot of great YouTube videos. LinkedIn groups. Just do a search for QuickBooks, and you will find a ton of them. It is amazing all the great free advice that fellow users provide. Google. I find many of my answers just by doing a search, as QuickBooks is so popular. This is great advice. I just have a new opportunity for a new client, and it was all the networking of QuickBooks and their data and how they had a peer-to-peer network set up where it was all messed up, and I was brought in to solve the infrastructure issues and make sure that the clients were all reading the proper data, and I had to change the permissions and the shares around and get everything connected, and it was great. I am seeing more and more QuickBooks work. Running into that a lot. So, Karen, thank you so much for getting back to me. Now, she has a question. I purchased a Dell Inspiron laptop this weekend with Windows 8 on it and purchased the Windows upgrade so I could set up virtual machines using Hyper-V. I have set up a Windows 7 virtual machine, and I cannot seem to figure out how to be able to browse to my host drive in my computer section from the virtual machine. Here are some of the things I have checked and tried. In the virtual switch manager, I made sure that I had checked off to allow management operating systems to share the network adapter, enabled integration services, made sure I installed all Windows 8 updates, even the optimal ones. Any ideas? Thanks so much. Great show. Now, when you said you're having trouble accessing the local shares of the machine, the first thing I want to know, are you getting out to the internet? Do you have network connectivity? Are you getting an IP address on that Hyper-V adapter, on the adapter you want for that, for the operating system that's the host? Not the host, but the one that you've installed. Make sure that you can get out to the internet and you can get out to networking. After that, it's just a matter of accessing the shares, pretending that it's a separate computer. When I look at my virtual machines on a host, I like to treat them like they are a completely independent computer, and therefore accessing like they're not on that machine. Pretend that that computer that's virtual, you make sure that you pretend that it's like a separate physical computer. Well, how would it access the shares of the local machine? Some virtualization softwares have things integrated in it. I don't believe Hyper-V does. I could be wrong. I've only worked with Hyper-V once in a server situation. VMware has a great question that it asks, VMware Fusion, when I'm installing it on a Mac, and it says, do you want this to be more integrated with the host, or do you want it to be more isolated? And if it's integrated, they allow the commingling of shared desktops, where if I have Windows 7 running on my iMac, I can actually make it where if I put something on the desktop of the iMac, it appears on the Windows 7 desktop, and vice versa. I don't like that sometimes. It's easy to get some cross-corruption and some, you know, unless I really, really have a compelling reason to do that, I like it more isolated. So therefore, I can't accidentally corrupt the host. It's therefore, if it gets infected or something goes wrong, it's not going to bring the host down. Make sure you can ping everything. Start with the basics for checking the network connectivity. Karen, let me know if any of this has helped, or let me know if you're having trouble. Can you first get to the internet? I need to know that we got basic network connectivity solved. Hopefully, I've given some tips for you, and I want to thank you so much for your response to QuickBooks and all of those great resources. I will have a section in the show notes dedicated to the QuickBooks resources that you've listed. Thank you. This is from Al. Hi, Mike. Sorry, been a while since I dropped you an email. You got to mention this on a future Mike Tech show from Britech's awesome YouTube channel. This is a Britech's antivirus comparison test. So, great link. Thank you. From Brandon, Ninite and Flash. Recently, you reported that Ninite stopped providing Adobe Flash. You may want to consider patchmypc.net. The download is portable and provides installs and updates for Java, Flash, Adobe Reader, etc. It does not install toolbars, just in case you are wondering. It also installs and updates lots of other software, such as MSE, Malwarebytes, and SpyBot. I personally use patchmypc.net and love it. Check it out and see how you like it. Thanks so much for the great show. Keep it up. Brandon, I downloaded it, checked it out. This is a thumbs up. Take a look at this. It's a different way of patching and updating your system, and it's called patchmypc.net. Free or low-cost conferencing software service. Mike, after hearing your show mentioned several times on the Lutrec show, I started listening to your podcast and love listening to stories from the trenches. I have come across a situation that has me stumped. I have had a few people ask me for good conferencing software services that also stream audio from the PC. One case in particular, the person is wanting to share movies with the participants so that they can review and comment for a webcast podcast while keeping the video synchronized for all participants. This way, their comments are about the same part of the film and not several seconds or 10 minutes ahead of the other. Any ideas? And this is Michael. I wrote back, the only conferencing software that I can recommend is GoToMeeting. And it's not because they used to be a sponsor. It's because that's one of the best services out there. And especially for something that's important in keeping the video synced, all of the tool set and features that comes along with GoToMeeting, it's a reasonably priced service for what you're looking for. I don't know of any free service, especially one given the requirements that you ask. Recommend GoToMeeting. This is from Ross. I watch your Ustream show. Great job. I want to start doing a podcast and was wondering what software you use to build your XML file for iTunes. The only one that I know of is Podcast Maker, but it's for a Mac. No Mac here. Thanks, and thanks for the show. I use Blueberries, and that's Blubrry, PowerPress Podcasting Plugin. It is a WordPress plugin that, once configured properly, and it is so easy to configure, and it's free. It's a free plugin to WordPress. Once you are done posting your audio, the link to the audio, and filling out your show notes, you hit publish, and automatically the XML file is generated. It's free, it's easy to set up, and that's PowerPress plugin for WordPress. The next link is a story and an incident that Kate shares from her blog, and I'm going to post the link in the show notes. The reason I mention this is I learned of a couple utilities that I have never used before. Well, especially one called Rogue Killer. And if you follow Kate's process of a client having trouble with pop-ups and problems, and it was the host file that was infected, but yet every time she looked at the host file and any utilities that looked at the host file, it said it was clean. But Rogue Killer fixed the problem. So thank you, Kate, for sharing that. And check that out and the utilities and the links that Kate used to resolve the problem. This next question's from Clark. Do you know of an alternative to Network Magic? I played and used Network Magic a long time ago. It's no longer available. Here's the deal, Clark. Yes, Network Magic basically took all of the networking things away and made it easy for you to share resources and files between different computers and different operating systems. And they took a lot of the difficulty out of it, and that's why it was called Network Magic. I would much rather you learn how to properly set up the shares and the permissions in a mixed environment than to use a magic pill that solves that. I don't like relying on those. I don't like relying on magic. I like to understand what's happening and to have total control of the sharing and the networking. So I asked the following. One, is there a replacement that you know of out there that could replace Network Magic? Or I'd rather go into, and I did this at my last Philadelphia Area Computer Society presentation, how to do the shares and sort of home networking tips, which is where I would rather you take that than to what happens if Network Magic stops working or there's a little problem with the software and everything breaks. And then you don't understand the core fundamentals of what's going on behind the sharing and the connectivity. I would rather educate you to understand how to do that properly than having that magic pill take care of it. Does that make sense? But if there is a replacement for Network Magic, is there anything out there? Please let me know. Andy, he asked, after you were talking about the bad updates from the likes of Adobe and Microsoft, I was wondering if you knew of a website that can tell us the current status of all the popular third-party programs that we all use. I believe there was a bug update or updates. I don't know what the website is. If anybody knows that, let me know if there's sort of like a status on updates to major software programs. I remember there being a database and a forums a long time ago, and maybe it was just security updates for the different antivirus softwares. I'm not sure, but what a great idea. There's got to be something like that out there that I'm just not aware of off the top of my head. Please let me know. And also, is there an alternative for the Ninite? And yes, and I mentioned that earlier in the podcast, and that's patchmypc.net. Thanks, Andy, for your email. This is a quick suggestion from Michael. Mike, I was listening to show 455 and hearing your story about your server install that went badly. I have had a few of those myself and had one that went 3 days before we could complete a swing migration with an SQL database. That's another story. After hearing how you handled the billing on the server you had the issue with, I screamed, no! I have learned the hard way to bill for the time I put in. Now, hear me out before you respond. I work with many nonprofits myself and will tell you a better way to handle this billing situation that is a win-win for both sides. Back to not charging for time worked. We record all time and charge for all time worked so the customer understands the time put in and the value of having some of that know what they are doing. So if we work 60 hours and we bill 60 hours now, when we get to what we actually get paid, I will then show a discount line on the invoice for the time we are not charging them for. So here is an example for simplicity's sake. We will use $100 an hour to make it easy to understand. So we bill $6,000. Then we discount 2,000 or 20 hours to get the bill manageable for the customer. So why do I do it this way? I have found that people never remember the value that you gave them if you don't show them your generosity, and the customer does not get used to paying a smaller amount every time you show up to fix something. Also, when they recommend you, they will not say, hey, he'll give you a special rate. He's a nice guy. The customer will understand that you get paid for the value of your experience. You will never run into a situation when you have to bill that customer for actual hours and they are thinking you should have billed them less. Now, back to the nonprofit. A better way to bill them was to bill them for your actual hours and show the discount as a donation of your time in kind. One, they are happy to pay the lesser amount and understand how valuable you are. And two, you now have a donation that is tax deductible. This is a great idea. A transaction on your side, a huge win-win. Now, with all that said, if I choose to charge less, I always show it as a discount on the invoice so the customer understands the value of my time and I actually get huge credibility points and customers understand the value of what you decide to give them. Just a thought. Others may have a different opinion, but I have less issues with future charges from the same customer, and when they recommend me, they understand the value of my services. The worst thing they can say about you is that you were a bit pricey. Now you were the cheapest help around and even discounts his services at a whim. Thanks. Keep up the great work and stories. The stories are great. And no, I don't feel so alone with weird issues when they pop up from my customers. Michael, great, great email. And I did, for the first time on the invoice that I sent to this nonprofit, I listed my hours. And then what I should have done, I didn't put it at a discount. I just put it at zero, but I put the hours. I like adding the discount line. That was a great idea. What I did is I zeroed out those hours, but yet showed the hours worked. But actually going across and then putting it, I really like that. Also, what a great idea to use that as a donation. That never occurred to me. I will definitely keep that in mind as I work, especially with organizations like that that are not-for-profit, that I can use as a write-off for a donation. Tremendous idea, Michael. That's why I love doing this show. Not just that email, all your email, your recommendations, your suggestions, your responses to my stories, and you sharing your stories and your input. This is what it's all about, to have these great tips and these great ideas. Thank you, everybody, for this. I want to thank everybody for using my Amazon link. You're doing an incredible job this month. Thank you for using Amazon.micnation.net. When you use that, a small percentage comes back to me and supports the show. Your price is the same. but the help that that provides in keeping the show running, helping me with equipment, it's incredible. And please continue to share that link with your friends, family, bookmark it. That's amazon.micnation.net. Thank you so much from the bottom of my heart. I want to thank everybody for all of your feedback, your great voicemails, your emails, your suggestions and recommendations, your great questions. It's what this show is all about. Thank you so much. A reminder for next week, the live show will be recorded at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on Thursday. I'll then be editing the show Thursday night and getting it put out there, because that's so important that I get it out, because Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, I'm not going to be around, and I wanted to make sure that I get the show done, get it in a timely fashion, and get it out. Just a reminder, the first show in May will be, I believe that's May 2nd, and I will be recording at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. Also, please continue to use all the affiliate links, not just my Amazon, but, you know, Malware Bytes Pro, and, of course, Fabs Auto Backup for Tech, great utilities, and also the Tech Builder website that Steve Cherubino has for you for building your tech website. Great, great. The links will be in the show notes. Thank you so much. Talk to you next week. Same time, same channel. Bye-bye, everybody.
You've been listening to The Mike Tech Show, a proud member of the Tech Podcast Network. Please visit techpodcast.com.